Welcome to the Joy of Healthcare podcast, where we discuss how you can make money and put people at the center of everything you do. This is our 10th episode, and I'm totally embarrassed to admit that I have never actually introduced myself. So here I go. I'm your host, Jessie Israel, a healthcare leader, and I work in population health. And my partner is Lucas Howell. He's a technology innovator and the reason why I am able to get this podcast published and out into the universe. He really does all the hard work. You can find out more about us at www.joyofhealthcare.com. Today, we are going to talk with Dr. Kyle Kinnearum and Daniel Pacheco. They're from the University of Colorado, and they run a program, an opioid training program called It Matters, to support primary care practices understand their role in opioid treatment. Before we get going, I wanted to share a couple of the statistics that I learned in doing research for this podcast. I was really surprised. I work in healthcare and have definitely heard about this opioid crisis, but had not fully appreciated the weight of the problem. No idea that this has become the leading cause of death for people under 50. Overall, like the leading cause of death for people under 50 is overdose from drugs, and that we're seeing a decrease in the life expectancy in America, and it's disproportionately affecting men. The male life expectancy has gone from 76.1 years to 73.6 years. Side note here, women are holding strong at 81.8 years. So go girls. When we're talking about opioids, what we're talking about is the morphine class of drugs. So there's lots of other things people can overdose on, but specifically opioids are things like oxycodone, Percocet, OxyContin, hydrocodone, which is Vicodin, fentanyl, morphine, and heroin. About half of the people who are dying, and last year in 2016, 64,000 people died from overdoses, which was as many people as died from car accidents and guns combined, which that really blew my mind. So half of those people that are dying have died on accident. And of those people that did die, half of those who died were prescribed the medication by their physician. So with those fun facts in your pocket, Dr. Kyle and Daniel are going to tell us a little bit about what we can do about it as healthcare providers, what primary care's role in that is. We're going to skirt around the issue of what hospitals may or may not be able to do, and how, if you're interested, you could get involved in being part of the solution. So I hope you enjoy the episode. Really excited today to have with me Dr. Kyle Kinnearum and Daniel Pacheco. What we're going to be talking about is the opioid epidemic. Dr. Kyle is a family doc and the Associate Director for Practice Innovation at the University of Colorado, where he helps assist the coaching and transition for primary care practices. Additionally, we have the project manager for a program called It Matters, which is Daniel Pacheco, and I'm going to let him go ahead and tell us what that means. So let's start off with some introductions. Dr. Kinnearum, do you want to start and just give us an overview of who you are and what you do?
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm a family doc, and I practice here in Denver, Colorado, and I've always been interested in how to improve the systems around healthcare that make it really difficult to care for our patients and for very difficult for our patients to achieve health outcomes. So I've been working with members in our Department of Family Medicine and around the state around improving primary care, especially, and also specialty care through practice facilitation, which is having coaches come into your practice and help you with quality improvement projects and implementing evidence-based practices to help your patients and to help your practice succeed in new models of care.
Great. Daniel?
Yeah. So my name is Daniel, and I've historically worked with FQHCs implementing community-based projects. So currently I'm the project manager for It Matters, and It Matters has two parts. The first is to train physicians to obtain their waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. And the second part is to have practice facilitation in the clinics by bringing facilitators to come in and train the entire staff on how to work with this unique population.
Great. Well, let's just dive right into our topic at hand here. We're starting to hear the word epidemic used a lot around narcotics and opiates. So I thought maybe you could give me a sense of what's going on nationally.
Sure. Well, it's definitely in the news. And it's in the news because it's becoming a more and more recognized issue in a lot of communities that now opioids, and when you think about opioids, we're talking about things, not only heroin and things on the legal market, but also prescription drugs like oxycodone and morphine that are finding their way into people's houses, people's communities, not for their intended purpose. Prescription drugs can often be helpful when dealing with acute pain, but people are now using it not just for pain control, but for the high. And they can be addictive and lead to really detrimental impacts on communities and lives. And we're seeing that play out with life expectancy. We're seeing that people are dying earlier now, especially in age groups and demographics that we didn't see early deaths. You know, the 40s and 50-year-olds that are now dying early, not because of any uncontrollable life incident, but because they're addicted to opioids and they end up overdosing. So this is happening across the nation. It's no longer just kind of this private issue that's happening on under highways and in big cities. It's now happening and it's spreading across the country in rural areas, in professional areas, in people that you wouldn't expect to have this issue, professionals.
And
teachers.
How do you see this? When you look at the cause of death, does this show up as poisoning, or why don't we see this kind of on the cause of death list?
Because it's a little bit complicated. That oftentimes it's not known why people die, but when you look at when these people are dying early, on their medication list is opioids, and oftentimes in combination with other risky medications. Sometimes it's a little bit more complicated and it's a little bit more buried in the details.
So the cause of death on the death certificate generally won't say opiate overdose.
It's more and more becoming a recognized issue, and it is coming up more and often that we're recognizing it and labeling it for what it is.
What about here in Colorado? Can you get us a sense of what we have going on here?
Yes, just like nationally, we are seeing a spike in opioid overdoses and deaths related to opioids. That's happening nationally and happening here. Our rates of increase are among the highest in the country when it comes to opioid overdoses.
How does it get started? So how do people get started on this train? You know, you mentioned that it's people in their 40s and 50s. What's kind of the path that you've seen most people take to become addicted?
Well, honestly, it starts with us in the healthcare industry. Oftentimes, it starts with people having real acute pain, whether it's from surgery, an injury, trauma, that they are given a prescription for opioids. That's done harmlessly and not intentionally. However, people are very sensitive to opioids and they realize, hey, my pain feels better. Well, after a while, and what we thought took a long time, it's actually happening faster physiologically, that people become dependent and become tolerant for the opioids. And all of a sudden they need opioids to feel normal. Instead of just to get rid of the pain, now they need opioids to feel normal. That's how it often happens, is that prescription opioids go on longer than initially intended. People now become tolerant and dependent on those opioids and they start looking for their next fix. That can often happen with finding the fix with prescriptions, but when those prescriptions either run out or don't increase with the patient's physiologic demands, then they look elsewhere and they look onto the street to either buy pills or taking extras that are just hanging around in people's medicine cabinets. And when those aren't available, then they reach for heroin, which oftentimes is cheaper. And we'll talk about the availability of heroin becoming easier to access in many of our communities than it ever was before. So it often starts with us in the healthcare industry and then ends up with these bad consequences.
And this is a totally loaded question, but what do you feel about, or how do we get away from when you have a surgery or a dental procedure, are you getting 90 days worth of narcotics with that or whatever it might be, right? It seems like the prescription is always 17 times more than the event itself.
That's right. And I think that one is education, right? That that we are a part of the problem, and that these long prescriptions, much longer than the normal recovery period for these events, are given to patients. Well, there's been a lot of work to scale back those prescriptions to something that's more reasonable. Also, having the long-term pain control managed by somebody who is in a better position to understand the longitudinal piece of the patient's history. So handing them back off to the primary care provider instead of the surgeon or the dentist being responsible for long-term pain control. Rather, give them enough to get back to their primary care provider who can then manage it has been one strategy that's worked well. Mm-hmm. The other strategy is maybe there are other things besides opioids that can help with pain. And trying those things first has been a major push, especially in emergency departments, among many surgical specialties as well.
I'm so glad you said that, because I'm not sure if that was on your pre-questions, but I've heard and seen a lot in the news about the opioid-free emergency department. And the first question that I have in my mind, and everyone does, is, but how do you treat pain, right? So if somebody comes in with an acute trauma, does that mean you don't give them any opioids? Or what does a narcotics-free ED look like?
I've yet to see one, so I'm not exactly sure.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought they did exist, but maybe
they probably don't. Okay. And look, I think the key here is that opioids have their place, but that place is not as broad and as expansive as we once thought, and we need to rethink what else we have to help with pain, including changing patients' expectations of being pain-free every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is a good point. Do you feel like a non-narcotic can do as good a job as some of the narcotics that we give?
Certainly, especially when we start to change the conversation with chronic pain away from what is your pain scale to how are you functioning at home? Are you able to get out of bed? Are you able to walk? Are you able to take your kids to school? Are you able to get to work? When you start looking at the functional outcomes rather than just what's your level of pain each day and each minute, and you're able to change that conversation with a patient, oftentimes many other things work better than opioids. Opioids have serious consequences and side effects that patients, when they consider their function overall rather than the pain specifically, other things work better. Physical therapy works better. Cognitive behavioral therapy, understanding how to cope with chronic illness, all are things that aren't even a pill, but also often work better with function than opioids.
So what you're saying is, in the future, our goal may not be to always be pain-free.
I hope so.
Okay. So some history about how we got here. It seems like there's been some misinformation distributed along the way. And I also wanted you to touch on what a pill mill is and your pizza delivery method.
Sure. This has been interesting digging into the history of treating opioid use disorders and how we arrived in the area that we are now. So a lot, as we mentioned, there has been a lot of issues with the medical industry starting this or being complicit and actually speeding up the opioid epidemic. That started with a couple things. At one time, the pharmaceutical industry came up with new treatments for pain using opioids. As those came on the market, it can all kind of go back to one little article. And it wasn't even an article in a journal. It was a commentary on an article in a journal that was not really peer-reviewed, but just said, in our experience in one hospital, we had 4 out of several hundred patients start on opioids that end up with an opioid use disorder. That was never fact-checked. It was never looked into. It wasn't a real study, but everybody started pointing back to this one commentary because it was in a prestigious journal saying, oh, opioids are safe. They don't cause addiction. So that happened at the same time that there were new drugs on the market that were available for prescription use. People felt comfortable saying they're safe, and now there are drugs that can treat pain.
What were some of those early drugs?
So MS-Contin, long-acting morphine, and then later on OxyContin, long-acting oxycodone came onto the market and were pushed aggressively. Fentanyl was another one that could treat pain very quickly in the trauma setting. But again, these things didn't stay within the nice little controlled confines of how we thought they were going to be used, and they got out and being used besides for pain. Another thing that happened is that pain became a vital sign. Untreated pain became something that was aggressively tried to be reduced. The hospital accreditation units came in and said, if you're not asking about patients' pain and dealing with pain just like you would with blood pressure, you might not be accredited. And even more scary for doctors, you might be sued. And some suits went in with patients actually won against hospitals and against providers because their pain wasn't adequately addressed. So pain became a bigger issue, was asked on every patient every 4 hours in many cases in the hospitals. We had medications to use, and also we had now this one little sketchy journal article saying it was safe. So those combination of things really revved up the healthcare industry's approach to pain and use of narcotics.
You bring up a really good point. We've recently been having this discussion about how do we, as a health system or hospital, how would you recommend that you even work on reducing your use of opiates? Because as we look at something like pain, that's not easy to measure. Do you measure their pain before they had narcotics? Do you measure it after they had narcotics? Do you measure an average of all of their pain scales that they give? Right, their pain at discharge, their pain at admission. It's taken every single shift several times because it's a vital sign. So as you're looking to, and what is the goal? Is it to reduce the number, the pain scale number, or is it to reduce the number of prescriptions that people leave the hospital with, or the number of times that we give it during their hospital stay? So that was a really long, you know, those are the discussions that we've been having around with some of our biggest health partners, with talking with Pfizer and Blue Cross about how do we be better in a hospital dealing with people's pain and ensuring that we're not giving them the prescription to leave with an addiction.
So I'm not an expert on exactly what should be done. I think that all of those ideas that you've had probably have their place, and there are probably other places where they won't work. I think that it's going to take a multiple strategies to address this. I think one of the things is not focusing on pain as much as function, setting patients up with an expectation that if their function continues to improve, that's the end result that we're going for. The handoff of how long and how, if we think about this like a loaded gun, how many bullets are you giving a patient? When you leave the hospital, how are you setting them up to be safe after they leave? In the acute phase, it's difficult because these opioids often are the most useful or quickest acting piece to deal with pain in the acute phase. But where this, where acute pain control turns into addiction, usually isn't in 4 days in a hospital setting. It's usually in the weeks and the months after people get out of the hospital. So how do you treat that? And I think that's where we're more interested in focusing, is how does what's primary care's role in treating pain and the specialties that interact with these patients in that kind of medium zone of how do we help those patients and those practices develop systems to avoid addiction?
Mm-hmm. So what is a pill mill and the pizza delivery method?
Sure. A pill mill is basically, there's a business case for giving out prescriptions for narcotics. People want them, and people will pay for the opportunity to get them legally. People abused that opportunity. And here in Colorado, we had several pill mills, as well as across the country, where people were using their prescriptive authority to give out prescription for opioids in a way that was reckless, that really caused harm not only to the individuals but the communities that they lived in. So those are being shut down and identified much more rapidly with things like the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which we have an excellent one here in Colorado and across the country. I believe there's 49 states with the ability to track narcotics on a hour-to-hour basis from who prescribes it, where they get it, and to identify areas and specific clinics and specific providers that overdo the prescriptions of opioids. That's becoming a rarer thing, but they still exist. You mentioned the pizza delivery method. This is really interesting that, again, when there's a market, when people are going to pay for narcotics, people are going to respond to that demand. And within the black market, people realized that the people who wanted narcotics weren't going to drive to downtown urban centers and go to those traditionally seedy areas where drug use was concentrated. So they said, well, if they're not going to drive down here, why don't we go to them? Just like pizzas, right? The pizza delivery folks figured out that people would rather wait in their home or be very close to home to get their pizzas rather than going into a restaurant. So if we deliver a hot, fresh pizza closer to their house, we can sell more pizzas. So that's what they did. They started moving their distribution closer to where patients lived, or people lived. These weren't even patients. These were people who wanted a fix. And so it moved into rural communities. It moved into suburbs where if you wanted some narcotic, you had not only your pizza delivery man on speed dial, you had your drug dealer on speed dial, and they would deliver it to your house within an hour. That made it much easier for people to get narcotics. And it just mirrored what they were doing with other things in business because there's money to be made.
It's the Uber Eats of...
It's the Uber Eats of narcotics, that's right.
Narcotics. I did notice in a presentation I was looking at of yours, which I found really interesting, is that in Colorado, our highest incident of opiate abuse is not in the inner city, but rather in the southern, poorer parts of the state. Is that, am I recalling that correctly? I'm looking at Daniel here. Where was our highest concentration? It seemed really interesting, like down in Pueblo.
Yeah,
down in Pueblo and San Luis Valley. Many of the rural communities are struggling with this in an intergenerational way. That it's not just young folks dabbling in illicit drugs. It's now a multi-generational issue that impacts poorer areas more significantly than more affluent areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also mentioned the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. I feel like people don't know what goes in there, and I have a sense that pretty much any time that you've had a narcotic prescribed to you, your name ends up in that database, whether or not that was for a dental procedure or anything. Can you expand on what that is and how we use it?
Yes. This has been one of the more exciting things as a provider, is to have a tool that can help me understand where patients are getting controlled substances. It's not just opioids. It's also stimulants that we use for things like ADHD. It's also for anxiety medicines like benzodiazepines. It tracks all those controlled substances in one place. Every pharmacy is hooked up to this, and when they prescribe one of these controlled substances, they also log it into this database. Within 24 hours, it shows up how many pills were prescribed, who prescribed it, how long it should last. That information is now available at our provider's fingertips. It's already integrated within in our EHR, which is Epic, but also other EHRs are having single sign-on access to the PDMP. So now I don't even have to remember another login. I just have to click another button, and I see a person's filling history, not just in my organization, but across the state. This has been a great tool to understand when patients are going to multiple providers asking for pain medications. It's kind of removed the curtain a little bit of our patients' behaviors when it comes to filling and having access to these controlled substances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was telling you before we were recording, we were looking at some patient records the other day, and we just took a deep dive into like a single 50-year-old patient who had died of a narcotic overdose and looked at his history. And in that prescription drug monitoring tab within the EHR, you could see that that person had been into multiple emergency departments in one day. They'd been to multiple physicians, multiple pharmacies. Right. So that was all of the encounters were drug related. And the only hospital encounters were something like abdominal pain, which is very consistent with somebody who's drug seeking. So it was just an interesting experience and one where it really made you wish that we would have that someone, and we're going to talk about the role of primary care, would have noticed all of these multiple encounters, but it's not obvious when the patient is not in front of you or in your office.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question. I'm going to get Daniel started talking. We are going to talk about the role of primary care here, but kind of a personal question. Have you ever had surgery, Daniel, or some time where you had to take narcotics?
No, I haven't. I think I'm actually allergic to codeine and everything else, so I have had to stay away from that anyway, so I have not had personal experience with it.
All right. What about you, Dr. Kyle?
Personally, I have had surgery, but I luckily recovered quickly and had a full bottle of Percocet sitting in my medicine cabinet for quite some time because I didn't need it.
Yeah.
Would you be reluctant to take it if you had a major surgery where you had a lot of pain, like a knee replacement or?
Yeah, my wife ended up having, blew out her knee skiing and had a tibial plateau fracture and ACL avulsion, and was on high doses of narcotics for several weeks. And it was very scary to watch. We both were looking at it saying, oh my gosh, when is this going to end? And what's going to happen? Because she needed narcotics to even sleep, to even move around the house. Nothing else was helping with the pain. And we both were getting nervous about how long this was lasting and was it going to be an issue. Luckily for her, when she recovered, it didn't turn out to be an issue. So we scooted around that. But we could have very easily seen if she was more predisposed, like some people are, to addiction and to being dependent on these medications. That could have been an easy trigger that I feel like we narrowly missed.
Yeah. But even, I think somebody like me, you know, becoming educated on the issues around this topic, working on this project, I've become, you know, of course, scared of using them myself. But even like with my family members and some of my nieces and nephews who are about to have their wisdom teeth out, looking into other options for pain management for them before they go in to have their procedure done, and just educating my family members and their parents on the issue, you know, it's really just education at really every level. And even friends at the gym who tore their ACL and they tell me they have a prescription for 30 days. And I'm like, no, it only takes 3. And I'm like, you need to call your doctor. You need to learn more about it. You need to read these articles. So it's really education at every level. And I'm still surprised to see that doctors are still prescribing them for such long lengths of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems very common still to get 30 days worth of a prescription for something, like you said, that only needs 3 days. So that brings us to our next part of the journey. So what if your wife or a person does have chronic pain? Right? How do we treat that long-term without long-term use of narcotics?
Looking for non-narcotic options. And I think we have to kind of split this up. We've already had a problem that's out there with opioid use disorder. And I think that one thing that we can do is treat opioid use disorder effectively and in an evidence-based way for the people that already have this disease, whose brains have already been hijacked by opioids. And I hope we get into that part of the discussion too about what we can do for that. Obviously, preventing this is a whole nother discussion, I think, around how do you treat chronic pain. I think that is a huge topic that I don't think anybody has a silver bullet for. And it's a multi-pronged approach. It's a multidisciplinary approach, that it's not just allopathic medicine. saying, here's our prescription pad, here's our diagnoses, come back and see me in a month and see how you're doing. That's a part of it. But it's also people like physical therapy, occupational therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic community. The community engagement and connectedness to a support group is also very important when it comes to avoiding chronic pain turning into opioid use disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's jump right into the role of the PCP. That's really where your area of specialty is. This is the primary care physician is more and more becoming the person who is the treater of long-term pain and or addiction. Right, so what can the PCP do?
One is recognize that opioid use disorder is an issue for their patients. So one of the things that we hear all the time is, well, I don't want to treat that type of patient. There is a real stigma amongst medical providers and amongst patients and our staff around what a patient with opioid use disorder looks like. They still imagine that the person who's on the street, homeless, 1,000 other comorbidities that will basically wreck your schedule for that afternoon. And that's the stigma that's there, but the reality is that these patients are the patients that we already see. The patients we already see are struggling with this issue. They're the doctors, they're the teachers, they're the lawyers. They are the professionals in our community that we would never expect it. And we just don't know because we don't ask. So I think the first thing that we can do is start to recognize the extent of opioid use disorder within our current patients. Don't be afraid about asking the questions, I think is the first thing that we can do.
What about the treatments? Buprenorphine is something that PCPs can prescribe. And back to your stigma, how do we convince more primary care doctors to engage with that? You do have to have some specialized training. Danielle, do you want to maybe just touch on what that specialized training is to prescribe that? And what is buprenorphine?
Kyle will be the expert on exactly what it is. But basically, it's a prescription medication that a physician will prescribe to somebody who's suffering from opioid use disorder. And what it does is it helps with withdrawals. And then also helps prevent cravings in the future. So what a physician needs is a MD or a DO. It's 8 hours of training, and it can be done online or in person. And NPs and PAs, it's a total of 24 hours of training. And again, you could do half online, half in person, all online. There's a few different ways that they could become trained. So the training is the first step. The second step would be for them to actually apply for their waiver to be able to prescribe that drug. So that is one way that they could help out this population.
And so how do we convince more people to engage? I mean, I think the discussion that we've had is that myself and some primary care providers, it's got to be an all or none approach. Right, we don't just want to have a couple of primary care docs with this prescriptive authority. Otherwise, all of that type of patient will burden that office. Right, so whether or not that's true or not, or everyone has it, so that way everyone can treat. So it's kind of an all or none discussion is the discussion we've had so far, which the easy button is none. So how do you get more people to sign up?
The good news is that there's a lot of excitement around and interest and enthusiasm generated by this being a national topic, that it's on the news, it's on the radio when you're driving into work. So people are aware of it. So they are wondering what they can do. And so the nice thing is that people are already wanting to learn more about buprenorphine. The bad news is there's a couple of hurdles, like Daniel was saying, to just being able to legally prescribe this for opioid use disorder.
Why is that? What's scary about buprenorphine?
Nothing.
Okay, nothing. Then why do you need specialized training?
So this is way easier to prescribe and way safer than hundreds of other medicines that we have been able to prescribe since the day that we left medical school. This is way easier than titrating insulin and way safer. The reason is political and it's historical, that oftentimes the addiction treatment or treatment of addiction was concentrated by policy, by law, by just historical culture within addiction treatment centers. And that has been perpetrated through many decades of laws. Finally, buprenorphine is one of the first with a reversal of those policies, that now people who receive this special training are able to prescribe not in a certified addiction treatment center. No longer do people have to go to methadone clinics to receive buprenorphine. People can do that anywhere that they feel they have trained providers that are connected communities for the wraparound services that the patients need. So this is really, it's not necessarily new. The data training or the data waiver came into effect in 2000. So it's been around for 17 years. And only now are people saying, hey, there's a crisis that now we need, now we have a new tool. So we're going through those hoops to be able to prescribe. The getting people from going from not treating at all to treating one patient is probably the hardest hurdle. To break down that stigma of, oh my God, who are these patients? It's going to overwhelm my capacity personally, as well as our clinic's capacity. It just takes a little bit of a leap of faith that oftentimes peer pressure can help. What else can help is this team training that I think, Daniel, you might want to talk about some of the team training ideas that a provider who's trained by themselves, way less likely to actually take that leap of faith by themselves versus if they're in a supporting team environment that everybody's on the same page to take that leap together.
Yeah. So I think there was it South Carolina?
Or North Carolina.
North Carolina, where they trained, I don't know, I'm just nice to know, is there like, say, 1,000 providers to be able to prescribe. And at the end of 2 years, only a handful of them, or only two of them were actually prescribing. So that just shows, you know, people's fear in actually taking on this population. So what our project is doing is training everybody from the front desk all the way to billing on what it takes to bring somebody on board. And so we say that if the provider has the support of their entire staff and everybody's trained, that they will feel more supported and be more likely to actually prescribe.
So we developed the High Plains Research Network, which is based here in the Department of Family Medicine, but they work primarily in the Eastern Plains, the rural communities of Colorado. We're hearing from their communities that they need more access to buprenorphine. They went out and looked for funding for years and finally got a grant through the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC, a federal agency, to study this. How can we get our rural primary care providers and communities to address the issue better? They developed a great curriculum for primary care practices and behavioral health clinics to train the clinic, these clinics. We had a great offer through a SAMHSA award, extra funding that came into the state through the Office of Behavioral Health to, again, expand access for medication-assisted treatments, buprenorphine, across the state. So we're taking that curriculum that they developed specifically for the rural communities and primary care clinics, and we're spreading that throughout the state so that anybody will hopefully, who has an interest in this, can also get the coaching and support and education to carry this out clinic-wide.
Does that include also prescribing Narcan? And can you just tell us really quick what Narcan is?
Sure. Narcan or naloxone is sometimes called a rescue medication. It's often used in a rescue medication context of helping patients who are going through an opioid overdose reverse that overdose right away. It helps save lives. It's an important combination of harm reduction and risk reduction with patients on high-dose opioids or who we know are already using illicit drugs, even if they aren't prescribed.
Do you send people home with that, along with buprenorphine?
We often send it home when we're sending home people with narcotics or are using heroin at high doses or risky behaviors with other narcotics, opioids. We can give a prescription for that. With buprenorphine, the nice thing is it's very safe. it is nearly impossible, I'm not going to say totally impossible, to overdose on buprenorphine because it has a ceiling effect. It only is a partial agonist. It only partially turns on the opioid receptors, which are responsible both for pain control and the euphoria, but also for the nasty side effects of respiratory depression and responsible for overdose. So buprenorphine rarely hits its ceiling effect before it hits those respiratory drivers so significantly.
Is it awful?
Is it awful? No.
Yeah, you know, if somebody was going through medication-assisted treatment, is it terrible? Or, like, what does that look like for the person coming off?
So you have to pick the right person at the right time. And so the right person wants to do something differently. They're motivated to not be on, not be hooked and constantly looking for their next fix. They have to be a little bit motivated. Or scared of the consequences of their current actions. You also have to pick the exact right time to start buprenorphine, and the induction of buprenorphine becomes an issue. And that can be a painful experience if you don't pick it at the right time. You have to have somebody right in the right window of in enough withdrawal that when buprenorphine acts to kick off the old opioids from the receptors and partially block those receptors, because it's a partial antagonist and a partial agonist. So you have to pick somebody right in the window of in enough withdrawal, but not severe so that they are miserable. And you want to give it right at the right time. That's for somebody who's taking opioids continuously. Now, that's easy enough to do. We have training on how to do it, when to time it, depending on what they're taking, how to set that up in your clinic. So it's very doable. But when you hit it right with the right patient, they feel so much better. They come back the next day or a week once they get the dose right, feeling like, oh my God, I can do this. I can go to work. I can wake up in the morning not thinking about where's my next fix coming from. And then they have the time, the space, the energy to start focusing on the other things going on in their life that oftentimes contribute to opioid use disorder. So I think that if you pick the right patient at the right time, it feels great for them.
What about people on heroin? So you mentioned that earlier, that how easily accessible, which gives me kind of a scrunchy face because I would never think that heroin would be easily accessible. What does the treatment look like for that? And why is it so easily accessible?
So this is the drug cartels. Just they figured out how to make black tar heroin cheap, and they figured out how to distribute it in the United States efficiently. So they can make a huge profit on heroin. So it is around the country. Anywhere that you want it, you can find it if you know how. I, like you, don't know how to find it, but our patients do. And it's in our communities and pretty easily accessible. Treating heroin with buprenorphine is very similar to treating patients using oxycodone. These are short-acting opioids. They start out quick. They hit you quick, and then they also die off within a few hours. It's not like methadone that lasts for days before it leaves the body. So these are short-acting narcotics treated like any other short-acting opioid. So timing it with heroin is very similar to timing with oxycodone. Stop at 12 to 24 hours before you start the buprenorphine induction to see if they're in enough withdrawal. So it's no different.
And do they need to be inpatient, or can you do this at home?
This induction can happen anywhere. Okay. What's really nice now is people are getting trained to do this in emergency departments, mm-hmm. in primary care clinics, in mental health centers, at home. It can be done usually with close coordination with the prescriber, but it can be done safely in any of those environments.
Interesting. So for the sake of time, I still have a little handful of questions. So I'm going to kind of rapid fire some at you because I do want to get to some of these answers. And I also want to get you out of here on time. What about the shortage of behavioral health, long-term support for these people? How do they get long-term support? Is it their primary care physician, or is there other resources?
There are a lot of other resources. If you have a primary care provider, ask them. Patients who don't have a primary care provider can get one, or they can go through the mental health centers. And there are also addiction treatment centers throughout Colorado. There's 20 of them in many communities that they can reach out to, many of whom have same-day access that they can walk in and get an appointment or get evaluated that same day.
Okay, thanks. What about our data? Our data is really old on this topic. It seems like all the statistics are from 2004, 2007. Why does our data suck so bad?
The good news is we have better data and new data. The CDPHE, Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, just released a county-by-county report on the prescription drug issues in every single county and for the state. It showed that in Colorado, there are 1.4 million people receiving prescription drug prescriptions last year alone.
Wow.
So the data is fresher. There's new data coming out because it's an issue and a priority, and also because of those databases we talked about before, we have information more readily available. So look for the new information. It's out there.
Okay. And as our listeners are primarily people in healthcare or those who want to get into healthcare, what would you recommend that we can do to help the cause?
I think anybody who is interested in buprenorphine as another tool to treat this opioid use disorders should check out the resources available. Right now, we have excellent funding available for over 45 clinics through It Matters 2 alone, as well as SIM practices, as well as the SIM efforts. There will be more funding coming. So asking your local practice facilitator, your regional health connector, or organization to look for those resources that are available to help you and your clinic with the knowledge and tools would be the next step. You can go to our website.
Yeah, it's our website's practiceinnovationco.org. And there you can see our list of different projects and just click on It Matters Too, and it'll show you how providers can sign up for the training and receive compensation, as well as practices can sign up for practice facilitation.
Great. So that's the best way to find you.
That's the best way to find us, yes.
Information. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. This was really fun and definitely learned a lot. So thanks a bunch.
Thanks for sticking with this episode. I know it was a little bit longer, but definitely an important topic. We hope that at this point you're feeling kind of scared and inspired to get involved. If you are in healthcare, we will get those links posted to our website, which is www.joyofhealthcare.com. Also, if you know somebody who you feel like they're taking pain medicines to feel, air quote, normal, would highly encourage you to be brave enough to have a conversation with that person, that there are treatment options out there, that they can go to their regular doctor, they don't have to go to a mental health clinic or a pain addiction clinic, but there are just regular primary care physicians who could help get them through that. So would highly encourage you to take that step in helping that person. Also, we still need more ratings on iTunes. I have no idea what this magic number is to show up on the star ratings. All I know is that it keeps telling me we don't have enough ratings. So I would love for you to go on there and tell us what you think of the podcast, what you want to hear more of, what you want to hear less of, topics that you want to cover. Of course, you can always email us directly or find us again at www.joyofhealthcare.com.